LGIM Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. I'm joined today by Olivia Trahan, fund manager in the Active Equities team. Good morning, Olivia.
Hello, Mark.
We've got used to rising life expectancy, yet lately the data seems to show improvement has slowed. Our increasingly unhealthy lifestyle may be why. Olivia, why should investors be thinking about developments in life expectancy?
So we have a number of different types of clients, but life expectancy should inform their investment decision for almost every client group. So the most obvious one would be for our defined benefit clients, where ultimately their liability and how much they need in the way of assets is determined by how long their scheme members are going to live. So very important for them. For our defined contribution and our retail clients, ultimately the question we often get asked by them is, how much should I save for my retirement?
Yeah.
And for them, again, that's going to be a function of how long they expect to live and equally what costs they expect to experience during their retirement. So that's why we're thinking about demography and also life expectancy specifically and how that's changing.
Mm-hmm. So I guess if you're living longer, you need to put aside more. If you're working for 40 years and living for another 40 years, whereas perhaps you used to only live for a few, 25 years after retirement, it's quite a big ask for your pension pot to increase by that level.
Yeah, and one of the great things that we're seeing with demography is actually that life expectancy is improving, but also what we've seen for a long time, and it's actually changing a bit, but for a very long time, is that healthy life expectancy has been improving.
Okay.
And so if people are having these great healthy lives into relatively old age, they need cash to spend on doing great things, and we're encouraging them to make sure that they've saved enough to do
absolutely.
So.
Oh, absolutely. So Olivia, what exactly do we mean by slowing life expectancy gains here?
Yeah, so this is one of those slightly complicated areas. So what we've seen basically for most of the last century, with a few exceptions, is that life expectancy has been continuously increasing. But what we've seen in the last few years, and it is actually only a relatively recent period, is that rate of improvement in life expectancy has mm-hmm. actually slowed down quite a lot. So what we've seen is over the last 6 years, life expectancy for the average person in the UK has increased by about 4.2 weeks. So a little bit, but not a great deal. Prior to that, the prior 6 years, that life expectancy had improved by 17.3 weeks.
Okay.
So we were seeing quite rapid improvement, and that rapid improvement has really slowed down. And so although life expectancy is kind of constant and moderately improving, we're no longer seeing the big leaps and gains that we were seeing historically.
Is the 100-year life still possible?
Well, the rate of progress that we're seeing at the moment would sort of suggest perhaps not. So what's fascinating is the divergence that we're seeing in life expectancy. So there are some pockets of the world, which academics refer to blue zones, mm-hmm. Where people genuinely live extremely long lives, even relative to that very high life expectancy globally that we now have in the West. So to give you an example, some of these pockets are places like Sardinia in Italy,
okay.
Okinawa in Japan. And it's really difficult for academics to kind of pinpoint exactly what it is that means
okay.
people live a very long life there. But there are some sort of common features that we do see. So some of those things are people live very physically active lives, but also they eat relatively healthy diets, so quite plant-based diets. Mm-hmm. And generally, they have quite strong social lives, so a lot of community engagement. And those are the sort of three very common factors. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly what it is, but those are the sort of general trends that we see in those areas.
Does the healthcare system in each of these places play a big role?
Well, they're very variable, actually. So, I mean, you see kind of Sardinian islands in Italy, where actually these lives are quite remote, and then mm-hmm. equally very sophisticated healthcare in certain parts of Japan. So no,
yeah.
not necessarily.
Okay.
It's more physiological health than medical care, I think.
So it's really societal care, as you were saying.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
What's really at the heart of these slowing life expectancy gains?
So this is the million-dollar question. It's a really hard question, and it's a great area of academic research and debate. The most sort of obvious area that we're seeing a lot of change is in people's lifestyles. And so that's the one that we're focused on. So going back to those blue zones, if you think about what kind of tangible tips they're giving us, ultimately it's that we should be relatively physically active and that we should eat well. I mean, your mum probably told you that when you're five, but unfortunately that's still the correct advice, it seems. So what we're really seeing, though, is that when we look at the long-term data on the UK, we can see that people's lifestyles are just not as physically active as they were historically. So got this amazing stat that comes from Public Health England, actually, which is that 41% of adults in England who are 40 to 60 don't walk briskly for more than 10 minutes per month.
Per month.
So relatively inactive lives. And actually, that their more general data has shown that people are 20% less active than they were in the 1960s. So our physical activity is just slowing.
But I guess that kind of makes intuitive sense in that people are driving to work more. More people are in the service economy. So it's kind of more desk related jobs than act on your feet jobs. And it's shocking to put it in such stark terms. But actually, it makes quite a lot of sense that people just really aren't moving as much anymore.
Yeah, definitely. I think we can all associate with, you know, having our shopping delivered, getting in the car to go to places, that we're not physically active in doing the day-to-day tasks that we perhaps our parents or grandparents would have been active in doing.
So I want to lead on with, what impact are these unhealthy lifestyles having on us, our society?
Yeah, so this is a kind of confusing aspect when we're talking about life expectancy. So there is some evidence that actually, although these chronic diseases that are a consequence of perhaps living relatively unhealthier lives. So the classic examples here would be things like diabetes, where it's related to obesity typically. That although they don't have a significant impact on reducing our overall life expectancy, what they do is increase the number of years that we live with disability. So the big picture trend is ultimately that our life expectancy is sort of broadly unchanged, but actually our healthy life expectancy might be declining. And that's the challenge.
Interesting. So you live longer, slightly longer than before, but actually the quality of those end of life years is perhaps declining?
Yeah, exactly. So a study that we've seen from the Netherlands kind of illustrates this quite nicely. So with obesity, when they're looking at as a factor in terms of diseases and what impact it has on life expectancy and unhealthy years of life, what they say is that obesity only impairs life expectancy by about 1.4 years, so relatively moderate impact. But actually, that the average person who is diabetic can expect to live for 5.9 years with physical disability.
Okay.
So quite meaningful change in terms of the number of healthy years of life that person's experiencing.
Interesting. So how can we deal with this as a society?
Yeah, so it's clearly an incredibly challenging issue. And the reason it's challenging is that we know anyway from the work that we've done previously in articles like our Aging and Wrinkles in Public Finance that when people are living for longer, that's obviously got great benefits for society, and that for individuals, that's a healthier life for longer, and that's brilliant. But for society, that's fiscally, that's quite challenging, because ultimately that's more years of people claiming pensions and equally more years of people needing healthcare, and our healthcare typically gets more expensive as we get older.
So, Olivia, how are world health markets set up to deal with these rising costs?
Yeah, so generally what we see anyway is that aside from a short window early in life, healthcare costs generally are pretty flat until our kind of middle age and then start rising. And that's generally true as we get age, we tend to have more health conditions to look after. But what we find with chronic disease is actually that accelerates that process and makes those conditions far more expensive to treat. So they require more medical intervention. And we can see that in the kind of data that we've got on the number of hospital admissions by age group. So what we've seen is a meaningful shift over the last couple of decades in the older cohorts in terms of the number of admissions that they're seeing.
That they're constantly having to go to hospital for more and more things.
Exactly. And what we also know is that chronic diseases are quite complex to treat. So they can have lots of other unrelated disease related to them. Mm-hmm. And for patients, that's obviously difficult, but also for the medical profession, that's complex and expensive to treat.
I imagine there are some really interesting companies that have taken that see this opportunity to if it's such widespread that there must be some opportunities.
That's totally fair. So one of the areas that is a really interesting area is around diabetes. So as we sort of alluded to earlier, type 2 diabetes rather than type 1 is very highly correlated with obesity. So clearly there are genetic factors that mean certain people are prone to diabetes. But the lifestyle-related disease is typically type 2 diabetes, and that's typically, although not always, associated with obesity. What we see in those areas is that insulin, the drug that you use to treat diabetes, is a complex drug to manufacture. And also we need quite sophisticated treatments because we need to monitor blood sugar and manage it throughout day, week, month.
Yeah. What
we see is that effectively, because it's a complex drug to manufacture, there are only really about three manufacturers globally of insulins. And equally, this is because of this unhealthy lifestyle trend, a very rapid growth area. So we're seeing the total addressable market in that area grow by just under 16% a year. So very rapid, both because of that structural trend, but also because the companies that are investing in insulin are increasing in sophistication in the types of products they produce. So what we see with Novo Nordisk is that they have a catchily called GLP-1, which is a long-acting insulin. So you take it once a week. And the benefit to patients is in efficacy, because ultimately they don't have to worry about injecting, ensuring they're getting the right level of insulin at different times of day. But equally, that it's been shown to have some benefit in terms of reducing weight gain or actually aiding weight loss, which ultimately is helping to partly address some of the underlying conditions as well.
How are world health markets set up to deal with these changes on a broader societal scale, from UK perhaps to the US?
So we see very different healthcare markets in different regions. So obviously in the UK, we have kind of broadly central procurement through National Institute for Clinical Excellence. That's not exactly how it works, but broadly. Whereas in the US, it's much more a private insurance model. What we do see is that up until quite recently, medical insurance companies and doctors have been broadly incentivized to treat a condition rather than perhaps address the broader package of conditions that a patient might have. So what we are beginning to see in healthcare is a shift towards personalized healthcare, but also managing the life cycle cost of managing a condition. So rather than you get paid for prescribing a drug, it will be you get paid for the clinical outcome that is better for that patient. And that's about driving the efficacy of healthcare ultimately.
So what's the broader fiscal response that could be employed here?
Yeah, so we talked earlier about how for governments, this has always been a challenge in the sense that as people live longer, there are more pensions to pay and longer burden of healthcare costs ultimately. But what we see with unhealthy lifestyles is, in a way, it's exacerbating that trend because, as we talked about in the case of diabetes and obesity, it may be that people actually have fewer healthy life years. And so that increases the cost of looking after them ultimately. So for governments, we've talked about this a little bit before, that ultimately there are kind of four policy levers to use to think about how to address those rising costs. One is to borrow more. That sounds nice. It's politically a great fix because no one opposes it today, but it's a big problem longer term. Given the magnitude of this issue, I think we don't really see that as a sustainable solution. So a quick fix, but probably not sustainable. The second area that we've talked about a little bit is about raising taxes. And we talked about this before, that the challenge you've got is that because of demography, actually the working age population is going to be shrinking. And typically in the UK, we've been focused on taxing income rather than wealth. So actually, if that pool of income from current workers is shrinking, there's less capability to tax ultimately. Yeah. But also that the majority of wealth sits in older cohorts. So what we see is that over 55s hold 60% of society's wealth. So it's going to be difficult to tax that.
And as they soon retire as well.
Precisely. And equally, these are people who are active voters, and not many politicians are brave enough to stand up and say that they want to tax wealth. So we haven't seen that yet. So it seems unlikely in the near term. So the other things that we've considered are the two other kind of policy prescriptions, as it were. The first one is pay for less or do it better. So that might be that government effectively doesn't take responsibility for funding certain areas of care. So we see that to some extent already with social care, which is not funded by the NHS. That's a totally distinct area. But we also have looked at sort of options to drive efficacy. So ways in which we can treat patients better. And if we're treating patients better and they're getting better outcomes, that might actually be cheaper. We can talk a bit more about that if you like. And then the final one is about raising the retirement age. So this is a really controversial topic at the moment. We've seen in Russia some discussion about raising the retirement age in Russia and the political ramifications for that. We're raising the retirement age in the UK. It's very progressive. It's one of the most effective solutions, because ultimately every year that you have the retirement age raised, that's 1 year less of pensions to pay ultimately. So it's very simple math. Yeah. The challenge with it is that as people are less healthy as they come into older age, but also what we on average see is that people are more likely to be impacted by chronic disease if they have lower levels of affluence. Mm-hmm. Can they actually keep people working for longer? How do you incentivize that?
Yeah, I'd love to go back to the efficiency angle, because that seems to be the current government's cause du jour of let's increase efficiency with what we've got.
Yeah, so this is a quite challenging area in that I think, unlike perhaps raising taxes or raising the retirement age, there isn't a big sledgehammer or big button to push where you get one great outcome. And so it requires lots of different small policy actions. But what we are seeing both from companies and also government is a focus on more sort of bottom-up small initiatives to use technology to improve the way that we care for patients. Mm-hmm. So that might be remote monitoring to ensure that we have accurate information about the patient's condition, and actually that we can consider when that they should see a physician. We also know that technology companies, so like IBM's Watson, are developing technologies which will improve the way in which scans are interpreted, for example. So they've got technology which can interpret scans and identify conditions on it as effectively as the medical profession can currently, or better. The challenge will be actually getting these implemented.
Okay.
So at what level are we comfortable introducing technology and removing people from caring for patients?
Exactly. If you, for instance, take on a medical device, do you also enter into a contract to consistently wear it and report back your medical data to this company?
And also, who are you comfortable having that medical data? So
yes,
lots of challenging issues there.
Exactly.
But those sorts of bottom-up small initiatives could drive the efficiency of healthcare, but I wouldn't see them as a single solution. So we need a broad effort on
that
front.
I mean, I'm reminded of perhaps the large insurers who offer Fitbits or gym memberships alongside their policies, which are kind of very small incentives to lead better, healthier lifestyles, but perhaps it's not a quick fix. That's not about to make the entirety of society a lot healthier.
No, it's definitely a long-term effort, but they're trying to incentivize the right behavior for the long term.
Absolutely. On the last point of raising retirement, this seems like the most easiest thing, the policy nadir of governments everywhere. And you know, if you can do it at the beginning, just after you've been elected, surely it works out. What's holding people back here beyond the very unpopular?
So I think one of the main angles that is quite challenging, and actually we've seen Labour politicians in the UK raise this point, is about inequality, actually. Mm-hmm. So what we see currently is there's quite significant divergence in terms of life expectancy between different income groups. So if we take, for example, a man at 65, what we see is that the life expectancy for somebody who is a man who is high income and relatively healthy lifestyle at 65 is about 23 years. Mm-hmm. If we take somebody who is low income and relatively unhealthy male at 65, their life expectancy is only about 12 years. So that 11-year difference is very significant in terms of what their life expectancy is. If we're asking everybody to work till, say, 70, the number of years in retirement is going to be meaningfully different for those two groups.
Yep.
So I think that's partly why there's some resistance to a universal way of raising the retirement age. Clearly, on average, our jobs are less physical than they used to be, but that's not true for everybody. Can everybody continue to work into a higher retirement age? And equally, you know, it going back to the equality argument, if it's the affluent who are going to live the longest, is it fair that the lower income groups are paying in for longer effectively to fund their retirement?
To fund their retirement. Wow, it's a tricky government policy that I don't want to be the one to fix.
So I think there are ways that this can be a more effective policy prescription, though. So it can be that we can incentivize people to work longer. Mm-hmm. And we see certain pockets of jobs where we see people working to quite older ages anyway, which is a great thing. So, for example, we were looking at some data on FTSE 150 chairman. The average age of a FTSE 150 chairman is 64 and a half, which means that presumably quite a lot of those people are working to significantly above the retirement age.
Exactly.
So there are areas. And equally, we see companies like BMW actually adapting the way that their production plants work. So cobots to work with workers, but also making the manufacturing equipment more ergonomic to enable people to continue to work for longer. So different ways of incentivizing people to keep going that are more than purely monetary, but obviously support the fiscal position as well.
To bring this back around to our very first question, will people need to think more about private saving for their later life healthcare?
I think that the demographic challenge that we're highlighting with this is ultimately that there isn't an easy political solution to enable government to raise more money to fund the kind of healthcare that we currently live to expect. And equally that those healthcare costs are just going to continue rising, not just because people are aging, but because unhealthy lifestyles accelerate that trend in rising healthcare costs. So because it's not obvious what the solution is, it may be that people wish to effectively self-insure and ensure that they have private savings to be able to fund their own care as they get older. And so, yes, we are seeing that. And we do see very strong rates of growth in assets for companies that are giving advice to people in terms of how to save for retirement. So, yes, I think a lot of people will be thinking about how to ensure that they have private provision as well as state provision if they can afford to do so.
Any kind of key takeaways you'd give to our DB clients who are also thinking about this longer life expectancy but quality of life in later years?
So I think for our defined benefit clients, they're already very focused on what's changing on longevity. What's obviously a mixed blessing for them is that if life expectancy is no longer increasing at quite the same rate as it was, actually their liability might not be evolving in quite the way that they had expected. But we're quite early in the day on that data, so it's quite soon to determine that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Olivia.
Thanks very much, Mark.
To find out more about what we've discussed today, be sure to visit our website and read Olivia's wonderful article, Unhealthy Living. I'm Mark Chappell. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.